watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A recent science fiction movie called The Matrix is set in a future world where humanity lies sleeping in a drug-induced collective illusion, connected to a monstrous machine that's sucking the life out of them while they dream that they are free people living out real lives. The hero of the film begins to wake and see through the illusion, and he finds others who are also waking. He's told that he may return to his fairly pleasant dreams by taking a blue pill, or take a red pill and face the unvarnished truth. Tonight's program will address our collective social illusions and make the case that we are, in fact, already the sleeping subjects of a totalitarian one-world government that views our lives much the way we view batteries in a flashlight, use them while they work, trash them when expended. Many of the facts, history, and analyses we'll present tonight have been addressed on previous editions of Unwelcome Guests, but not quite this way. You will have to decide whether these are paranoid ravings or descriptions of truth that, once acknowledged, require a transformation from oblivion to resistance. If what we present to you rings true, I urge you to pass this information to friends, family, co-workers, even strangers, and begin a dialogue with them. I think that this is the most important, provocative, and difficult material that we have presented on this program in the close to 2 years of its existence. I urge anyone who can tape the broadcast, download copies of the program from the internet, or follow up with the text links provided on our website, www.radioforall.org/unwelcome.
They take it by stealing and lying and gambling. I take it my way, my shiny black best. I treat horses good.
Richard K. Moore is an American expatriate writer living in Ireland who operates a website, cyberjournal.org. Moore describes himself as having been a college student in California in the mid-1960s who was radicalized by the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements. Throughout the years, as he pursued a career in the software industry, he continued to observe events from a radical perspective. He read histories, biographies, and political analysis, trying to understand how our system operates, where it came from, and where it's headed. He said that he found little value in grand theories of history, or economics, or social change. They all seemed narrow, or biased, or overeager to explain everything by some single cause or single principle. In 1994, he left Silicon Valley and moved to Ireland in order to devote full time to his investigations and to writing. His articles have appeared in a variety of magazines and journals, and he has been invited to speak at numerous conferences. All the while, his ideas have continued to develop and change, primarily due to what he has learned through dialogue with others on the internet. He has sought out discussion groups of all sorts, right-wing, left-wing, academic, establishment, activist, environmentalist, Marxist, whatever. He sought every viewpoint he could find a forum on the net where he could talk to the self-appointed experts and get to the heart of what that viewpoint has to offer and what its blind spots are. A friend recently sent me an article by Moore that was first published in June of 2000. It is titled, Escaping the Matrix. For the next 40 minutes, I'm going to read you that article in its entirety. Links to a text version which contains Moore's references and bibliography will be available on the Unwelcome Guest website at radioforall.org/unwelcome. Moore begins the article by asking, Are you ready for the red pill? The defining dramatic moment in the film The Matrix occurs just after Morpheus invites Neo to choose between a red pill and a blue pill. The red pill promises the truth, nothing more. Neo takes the red pill and awakes to reality, something utterly different from anything Neo or the audience could have expected. What Neo had assumed to be reality turned out to be only a collective illusion, fabricated by the Matrix and fed to a population that is asleep, cocooned in grotesque embryonic pods. In Plato's famous parable about the shadows on the walls of the cave, true reality is at least reflected in perceived reality. In the Matrix world, true reality and perceived reality exist on entirely different planes. The story is intended as a metaphor, and the parallels that drew my attention had to do with political reality. This article offers a particular perspective on what's going on in the world and how things got to be that way in this era of globalization. From that red pill perspective, everyday media consensus reality, like the Matrix in the film, is seen to be a fabricated collective illusion. Like Neo, I didn't know what I was looking for when my investigation began, but I knew that what I was being told didn't make sense. I read scores of histories and biographies, observing connections between them, and began to develop my own theories about roots of various historical events. I found myself largely in agreement with writers like Noam Chomsky and Michael Parenti, but I also perceived important patterns that others seemed to have missed. When I started tracing historical forces and began to interpret present-day events from a historical perspective, I could see the same old dynamics at work and found a meaning in the unfolding events far different from what official pronouncements proclaimed. Such pronouncements are, after all, public relations fare given out by politicians who want to look good to the voters. Most of us expect rhetoric from politicians and take what they say with a grain of salt. But as my own picture of present reality came into focus, grain of salt no longer worked as a metaphor. I began to see that consensus reality, as generated by official rhetoric and amplified by mass media, bears very little relationship to actual reality. The Matrix was a metaphor I was ready for. In consensus reality, the blue pill perspective, left and right are two ends of the political spectrum. Politics is a tug of war between competing factions carried out by political parties and elected representatives. Society gets pulled this way and that within the political spectrum, reflecting the interests of whichever party won the last election. The left and right are therefore political enemies. Each side is convinced that it knows how to make society better. Each believes the other enjoys undue influence, and each blames the other for the political stalemate that apparently prevents society from dealing effectively with its problems. This perspective on the political process, and on the roles of left and right, is very far from reality. It is a fabricated collective illusion. Morpheus tells Neo that the Matrix is the world that was pulled over your eyes to hide you from the truth. As long as the Matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. Consensus political reality is precisely such a matrix. Later, we'll take a fresh look at the role of left and right and at national politics. But first, we must develop our red pill historical perspective. I've had to condense the arguments to bare essentials. Please see the annotated sources at the end for more thorough treatments of particular topics. Imperialism and the Matrix. From the time of Columbus to 1945, world affairs were largely dominated by competition among Western nations seeking to stake out spheres of influence, control sea lanes, and exploit colonial empires. Each Western power became the core of an imperialist economy whose periphery was managed for the benefit of the core nation. Military might determined the scope of an empire. Wars were initiated when a core nation felt it had sufficient power to expand its periphery at the expense of a competitor. Economies and societies in the periphery were kept backward, to keep their populations under control, to provide cheap labor, and to guarantee markets for goods manufactured at the core. Imperialism robbed the periphery not only of wealth, but also of its ability to develop its own societies, cultures, and economies in a natural way for local benefit. The driving force behind Western imperialism has always been the pursuit of economic gain, ever since Isabella commissioned Columbus on his first entrepreneurial voyage. The rhetoric of empire concerning wars, however, has typically been about other things: the white man's burden, bringing true religion to the heathens, manifest destiny, defeating the yellow peril or the Hun, seeking Laban's realm, or making the world safe for democracy. Any fabricated motivation for war or empire would do, as long as it appealed to the collective consciousness of the population at the time. The propaganda lies of yesterday were recorded and became consensus history, the fabric of the Matrix. While the costs of territorial empire, fleets, colonial administrations, etc., were borne by Western taxpayers generally, the profits of imperialism were enjoyed primarily by private corporations and investors. Government and corporate elites were partners in the business of imperialism. Empires gave government leaders power and prestige, and gave corporate leaders power and wealth. Corporations ran the real business of empire, while government leaders fabricated noble excuses for the wars that were required to keep that business going. Matrix reality was about patriotism, national honor, and heroic causes. True reality was on another plane altogether, that of economics. Industrialization, beginning in the late 1700s, created a demand for new markets and increased raw materials. Both demands spurred accelerated expansion of empire. Wealthy investors amassed fortunes by setting up large-scale industrial and trading operations, leading to the emergence of an influential capitalist elite. Like any other elite, capitalists used their wealth and influence to further their own interests however they could. And the interests of capitalism always come down to economic growth. Investors must reap more than they sow, or the whole system comes to a grinding halt. Thus, capitalism, industrialization, nationalism, warfare, imperialism, and the Matrix co-evolved. Industrialized weapon production provided the muscle of modern warfare, and capitalism provided the appetite to use that muscle. Government leaders pursued the politics necessary to expand empire while creating a rhetorical matrix around nationalism to justify those policies. Capitalist growth depended on empire, which in turn depended on a strong and stable core nation to defend it. National interests and capitalist interests were inextricably linked, or so it seemed, for more than two centuries. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Continuing. World War II and Pax Americana. 1945 will be remembered as a year World War II ended and the bond of the atomic nucleus was broken. But 1945 also marked another momentous fission, the breaking of the bond between national and capitalist interests. After every previous war, and in many cases after severe devastation, European nations had always picked themselves back up and resumed their competition over empire. But after World War II, a Pax Americana was established. The U.S. began to manage all the Western peripheries on behalf of capitalism generally, while preventing the communist powers from interfering in the game. Capitalist powers no longer needed to fight over investment realms, and competitive imperialism was replaced by collective imperialism. Opportunities for capital growth were no longer linked to the military power of nations apart from the power of America. In his Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II, William Blum chronicles hundreds of significant covert and overt interventions, showing exactly how the U.S. carried out its imperial management role. In the post-war years, Matrix reality diverged ever further from actual reality. In the post-war Matrix world, imperialism had been abandoned, and the world was being, quote, democratized. In the real world, imperialism had become better organized and more efficient. In the Matrix world, the U.S., quote, restored order, or, quote, came to the assistance of nations which were being, quote, undermined by Soviet influence, unquote. In the real world, the periphery was being systematically suppressed and exploited. In the Matrix world, the benefit was going to the periphery in the form of countless aid programs. In the real world, immense wealth was being extracted from the periphery. Growing glitches in the Matrix weren't noticed by most people in the West because the post-war years brought unprecedented levels of Western prosperity and social progress. The rhetoric claimed progress would come to all, and Westerners could see it being realized in their own towns and cities. The West became the collective core of a global empire, and exploitative development led to prosperity for Western populations, while generating immense riches for corporations, banks, and wealthy capital investors. Glitches in the Matrix, Popular Rebellion, and Neoliberalism. The parallel agenda of Third World exploitation and Western prosperity worked effectively for the first two post-war decades. But in the 1960s, large numbers of Westerners, particularly the young and well-educated, began to notice glitches in the Matrix. In Vietnam, imperialism was too naked to be successfully masked as something else. A major split in American public consciousness occurred as millions of anti-war protesters and civil rights activists punctured the fabricated consensus of the 1950s and declared the reality of exploitation and suppression, both at home and abroad. The environmental movement arose, challenging even the exploitation of the natural world. In Europe, 1968 joined 1848 as a landmark year of popular protest. These developments disturbed elite planners. The post-war regime's stability was being challenged from within the core, and the formula of Western prosperity no longer guaranteed public passivity. A report published in 1975, the report of the Trilateral Task Force on Governability of Democracies, provides a glimpse into the thinking of elite circles. Alan Wolfe discusses this report in Holly Sklar's eye-opening work, Trilateralism. Wolfe focuses especially on the analysis Harvard professor Samuel P. Huntington presented in a section of the report entitled The Crisis of Democracy. Huntington is an articulate promoter of elite policy shifts and contributes pivotal articles to publications such as the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs. Huntington tells us that democratic societies cannot work, quote-unquote, unless the citizenry is, quote, passive. The, quote, democratic surge of the 1960s represented an, quote, excess of democracy, which must be reduced if governments are to carry out their traditional domestic and foreign policies. Huntington's notion of traditional policies is expressed in a passage from the report, quote, "To the extent that the United States was governed by anyone during the decades after World War II, it was governed by the president, acting with the support and cooperation of key individuals and groups in the executive office, the federal bureaucracy, Congress, and the more important businesses, banks, law firms, foundations, and media, which constitute the private sector's establishment." Close quote. In these few words, Huntington spells out the reality that electoral democracy has little to do with how America is run, and summarizes the kind of people who are included within the elite planning community. Who needs conspiracy theories when elite machinations are clearly described in public documents like these? Besides failing to deliver popular passivity, the policy of prosperity for Western populations had another downside, having to do with Japan's economic success. Under the Pax Americana umbrella, Japan had been able to industrialize and become an imperial player. the prohibition on Japanese rearmament had become irrelevant. With Japan's then lower living standards, Japanese producers could undercut prevailing prices and steal market share from Western producers. Western capital needed to find a way to become more competitive on world markets, and Western prosperity was standing in the way. Elite strategists, as Huntington showed, were fully capable of understanding these considerations, and the requirements of corporate growth created a strong motivation to make the needed adjustments in both reality and rhetoric. If popular prosperity could be sacrificed, there were many obvious ways Western capital could be made more competitive. Production could be moved overseas to low-wage areas, allowing domestic unemployment to rise. Unions could be attacked and wages forced down. And people could be pushed into temporary and part-time jobs without benefits. Regulations governing corporate behavior could be removed. Corporate and capital gains taxes could be reduced, and the revenue losses could be taken out of public service budgets. Public infrastructures could be privatized, the services reduced to cut costs, and then they could be milked for easy profits when they deteriorated from neglect. These are the very policies and programs launched during the Reagan-Thatcher years in the U.S. and Britain. They represent a systematic project of increasing corporate growth at the expense of popular prosperity and welfare. Such a real agenda would have been unpopular, and a corresponding matrix reality was fabricated for public consumption. The matrix reality used terms like deregulation, reduced taxes, and privatization, but around them was woven an economic mythology. The old, failed, laissez-faire doctrine of the 1800s was reintroduced with the help of Milton Friedman's Chicago School of Economics, and less government became the proud modern theme in America and Britain. Sensible regulations had restored financial stability after the Great Depression and had broken up anti-competitive monopolies such as the Rockefeller Trust and AT&T. But in the new matrix reality, all regulations were considered bureaucratic interference. Reagan and Thatcher preached the virtues of individualism and promised to, quote, get government off people's backs, unquote. The implication was that everyday individuals were to get more money and freedom, but in reality, the primary benefits would go to corporations and wealthy investors. The academic term for laissez-faire economics is economic liberalism, and hence the Reagan-Thatcher revolution has come to be known as the neoliberal revolution. It brought a radical change in actual reality by returning to the economic philosophy that led to sweatshops, corruption, and robber baron monopolies in the 19th century. It brought an equally radical change in matrix reality, a complete reversal in the attitude that was projected regarding government. Government policies had always been criticized in the media, but the institution of government had always been respected, reflecting the traditional bond between capitalism and nationalism. With Reagan, we had a sitting president telling us that government itself was a bad thing. Many of us may have agreed with him, but such a sentiment had never before found official favor. Soon, British and American populations were beginning to applaud the destruction of the very democratic institutions that provided their only hope of participation in the political process. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Continuing. Globalization and World Government. The essential bond between capitalism and nationalism was broken in 1945, but it took some time for elite planners to recognize this new condition and to begin bringing the world system into alignment with it. The strong Western nation-state had been the bulwark of capitalism for centuries, and initial post-war policies were based on the assumption that this would continue indefinitely. The Bretton Woods financial system, the IMF, World Bank, and a system of fixed exchange rates among major currencies was set up to stabilize national economies, and popular prosperity was encouraged to provide political stability. Neoliberalism in the U.S. and Britain represented the first serious break with this policy framework and brought the first visible signs of the fission of the nation capital bond. The neoliberal project was economically profitable in the U.S. and Britain, and the public accepted the matrix economic mythology. Meanwhile, the integrated global economy gave rise to a new generation of transnational corporations, and corporate leaders began to realize that corporate growth was not dependent on a strong core nation state. Indeed, Western nations, with their environmental laws, consumer protection measures, and other forms of regulatory interference, were a burden on corporate growth. Having been successfully field-tested in the two oldest, quote-unquote, democracies, the neoliberal project moved onto the global stage. The Bretton Woods system of fixed rates of currency exchange was weakened, and the international financial system became destabilizing instead of stabilizing for national economies. The radical free trade project was launched, leading eventually to the World Trade Organization. The fission that had begun in 1945 was finally manifesting as an explosive change in the world system. The objective of neoliberal free trade treaties is to remove all political controls over domestic and international trade and commerce. Corporations have free rein to maximize profits, heedless of environmental consequences and safety risks. Instead of governments regulating corporations, the WTO now sets rules for governments, telling them what kind of beef they must import, whether or not they can ban asbestos, and what additives they must permit in petroleum products. So far, in every case where the WTO has been asked to review a health, safety, or environmental regulation, the regulation has been overturned. Most of the world has been turned into a periphery. The imperial core has boiled down to the capitalist elite themselves, represented by their bureaucratic, unrepresentative WTO world government. The burden of accelerated imperialism falls hardest outside the West, where loans are used as a lever by the IMF to compel debtor nations such as Rwanda and South Korea to accept suicidal, quote, reform packages. In the 1800s, genocide was employed to clear North America and Australia of their native populations, creating room for growth. Today, a similar program of genocide has apparently been unleashed against sub-Saharan Africa. The IMF destroys the economies. The CIA trains militias and stirs up tribal conflicts. And the West sells weapons to all sides. Famine and genocidal civil wars are the predictable and inevitable result. Meanwhile, AIDS runs rampant while the WTO and the U.S. government use trade laws to prevent medicines from reaching the victims. As in the past, Western military force will be required to control the non-Western periphery and make adjustments to local political arrangements when considered necessary by elite planners. The Pentagon continues to provide the primary policing power, with NATO playing an ever-increasing role. Resentment against the West and against neoliberalism is growing in the Third World, and the frequency of military interventions is bound to increase. All of this needs to be made acceptable to Western minds, adding a new dimension to the Matrix. In the latest Matrix reality, the West is called the international community, whose goal is to serve humanitarian causes. Bill Clinton made it explicit with his Clinton Doctrine, in which, as quoted in the Washington Post, he solemnly promised, quote, "If somebody comes after innocent civilians and tries to kill them en masse because of their race, their ethnic background, or their religion, and it is within our power to stop it, We will stop it, close quote. This matrix fabrication is very effective indeed. Who opposes prevention of genocide? Only outside the matrix does one see that genocide is caused by the West in the first place, and that the worst cases of genocide are continuing, that assistance usually makes things worse, as in the Balkans, and that Clinton's handy doctrine enables him to intervene when and where he chooses, since dictators and the stirring of ethnic rivalries are standard tools in managing the periphery. A U.S. president can always find, quote, innocent civilians, wherever elite plans call for an intervention. In Matrix reality, globalization is not a project, but rather the inevitable result of beneficial market forces. Genocide in Africa is no fault of the West, but is due to ancient tribal rivalries. Every measure demanded by globalization is referred to as reform. The word is never used with irony. Democracy and reform are frequently used together, always leaving the subtle impression that one has something to do with the other. The illusion is presented that all economic boats are rising, and if yours isn't, it must be your own fault. You aren't competitive enough. Economic failures are explained away as temporary adjustments, or else the victim, as in South Korea or Russia, is blamed for not being sufficiently neoliberal. Investor confidence is referred to with the same awe and reverence that earlier societies might have expressed towards the will of the gods. The Western quality of life continues to decline, while the WTO establishes legal precedents ensuring that its authority will not be challenged when its decisions become more draconian. Things will get much worse in the West. This was anticipated in elite circles when the neoliberal project was still on the drawing board, as is illustrated in Samuel Huntington's The Crisis of Democracy report discussed earlier. The management of discontented societies. The post-war years, especially in the United States, were characterized by consensus politics. Most people shared a common understanding of how society worked and generally approved of how things were going. Prosperity was real, and the Matrix version of reality was reassuring. Most people believed in it. Those beliefs became a shared consensus, and the government could then carry out its plans as intended, responding to the programmed public will. The excess democracy of the 1960s and 1970s attacked this shared consensus from below, and neoliberal planners decided from above that ongoing consensus wasn't worth paying for. They accepted that segments of society would persist in disbelieving various parts of the matrix. Activism and protest were to be expected. New means of social control would be needed to deal with activist movements and with growing discontent, as neoliberalism gradually tightened the economic screws. Such means of control were identified and have since been largely implemented, particularly in the United States. In many ways, America sets the pace of globalization. Innovations can often be observed there before they occur elsewhere. This is particularly true in the case of social control techniques. The most obvious means of social control in a discontented society is a strong, semi-militarized police force. Most of the periphery had been managed by such means for centuries. This was obvious to elite planners in the West, was adopted as policy, and has now been largely implemented. Urban and suburban ghettos, where the adverse consequences of neoliberalism are currently most concentrated, have literally become occupied territories where police beatings and unjustified shootings are commonplace, so that the beefed-up police force could maintain control in conditions of mass unrest. Elite planners also realized that much of the Bill of Rights would need to be neutralized. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government. Let me say that again. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government. The Rights Neutralization Project has been largely implemented, as exemplified by armed midnight raids, outrageous search and seizure practices, overly broad conspiracy laws, wholesale invasion of privacy, massive incarceration, and the rise of prison slave labor. The Rubicon has been crossed. The techniques of oppression, long common in the empire's periphery, are being imported to the core. In The Matrix, the genre of the TV or movie police drama has served to create a reality in which rights are a joke, the accused are despicable sociopaths, and no criminal is ever brought to justice until some noble cop or prosecutor bends the rules a bit. Government officials bolster the construct by declaring wars on crime and drugs, and noble cops are fighting a war out there in the streets, and you can't win a war without using your enemy's dirty tricks. The CIA plays its role by managing the international drug trade and making sure that ghetto drug dealers are well supplied. In this way, the American public has been led to accept the means of its own suppression. The mechanisms of the police state are in place. They will be used when necessary, as we see in ghettos and skyrocketing prison populations, as we saw on the streets of Seattle and Washington, D.C. during recent anti-WTO demonstrations, and as is suggested by executive orders that enable the president to suspend the Constitution and declare martial law whenever he deems it necessary. But raw force is only the last line of defense for the elite regime. Neoliberal planners introduced more subtle defenses into the matrix. Looking at these will bring us back to our discussion of the left and right. Divide and rule is one of the oldest means of mass control, standard practice since at least the Roman Empire. This is applied at the level of modern imperialism, where each small nation competes with others for capital investments. Within societies, it works this way. If each social group can be convinced that some other group is the source of its discontent, then the population's energy will be spent in intergroup struggles. The regime can sit on the sidelines, intervening covertly to stir things up or guide them in desired directions. In this way, most discontent can be neutralized and force can be reserved for exceptional cases. In the prosperous post-war years, consensus politics served to manage the population. Under neoliberalism, programmed factionalism has become the frontline defense, the matrix version of divide and rule. The covert guiding of various social movements has proven to be one of the most effective means of programming factions and stirring them against one another. Fundamentalist religious movements have been particularly useful. They have been used not only within the U.S., but also to maximize divisiveness in the Middle East and for other purposes throughout the empire. The collective energy and dedication of true believers makes them a potent political weapon that movement leaders can readily aim where needed. In the U.S., that weapon has been used to promote censorship on the Internet, to attack the women's movement, to support repressive legislation, and generally to bolster the ranks of what is called in The Matrix the right wing. In The Matrix, the various factions believe that their competition with each other is the process that determines society's political agenda. Politicians want votes, and hence the biggest and best organized factions should have the most influence, and their agendas should get the most political attention. In reality, there is only one significant political agenda these days, the maximization of capital growth Through the dismantling of society, the continuing implementation of neoliberalism, and the management of empire. Clinton's liberal rhetoric and his playing around with health care and gay rights are not the result of liberal pressure. They are rather the means by which Clinton is sold to liberal voters, so that he can proceed with real business, getting NAFTA through Congress, promoting the WTO, giving away the public airwaves, justifying military interventions, and so forth. Issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I repeat, issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Escaping the Matrix. The Matrix cannot fool all of the people all of the time. Under the onslaught of globalization, the glitches are becoming ever more difficult to conceal, as earlier with the Vietnam War. November's anti-establishment demonstrations in Seattle, the largest in decades, were aimed directly at globalization and the WTO. Even more important, Seattle saw the coming together of factions that the Matrix had programmed to fight one another, such as left-leaning environmentalists and socially conservative union members. Seattle represented the tip of an iceberg. A mass movement against globalization and elite rule is ready to ignite like a brush fire on a dry, scorching day. The establishment has been expecting such a movement and has a variety of defenses at its command, including those used effectively against the movements of the 1960s and 1970s. In order to prevail against what seems like overwhelming odds, the movement must escape entirely from the Matrix, and it must bring the rest of society with it. As long as the Matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. The whole truth must be faced. Globalization is centralized tyranny. Capitalism has outlasted its sell-by date. Matrix democracy is elite rule. And market forces are imperialism. Left and right are enemies only in the matrix. In reality, we are all in this together, and each of us has a contribution to make toward a better world. Marx may have failed as a social visionary, but he had capitalism figured out. It is based not on productivity or social benefit, but on the pursuit of capital growth through exploiting everything in its path. The job of elite planners is to create new spaces for capital to grow in. Competitive imperialism provided growth for centuries. Collective imperialism was invented when still more growth was needed, and then neoliberalism took over. Like a cancer, capitalism consumes its host and is never satisfied. The capital pool must always grow more and more forever, until the host dies. Or capitalism is replaced. The Matrix equates capitalism with free enterprise and defines centralized state planning socialism as the only alternative to capitalism. In reality, capitalism didn't amount to much of a force until the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution of the late 1700s, and we certainly cannot characterize all prior societies as socialist. Free enterprise, private property, commerce, banking, international trade, economic specialization, all of these had existed for millennia before capitalism. Capitalism claims credit for modern prosperity, but credit would be better given to developments in science and technology. Before capitalism, Western nations were generally run by aristocratic classes. The aristocratic attitude toward wealth focused on management and maintenance. With capitalism, the focus is always on growth and development. Whatever one has is but the seeds to build a still greater fortune. In fact, there are infinite alternatives to capitalism, and different societies can choose different systems, once they are free to do so. As Morpheus put it, outside the matrix, everything is possible. And there are no limits. The Matrix defines democracy as competitive party politics because that is a game wealthy elites have long since learned to corrupt and manipulate. Even in the days of the Roman Republic, the techniques were well understood. Real-world democracy is possible only if the people themselves participate in setting society's direction. An elected official can only truly represent a constituency after that constituency has worked out its positions, from the local to the global, on the issues of the day. For that to happen, the interests of different societal factions must be harmonized through interaction and discussion. Collaboration, not competition, is what leads to effective harmonization. In order for the movement to end elite rule and establish livable societies to succeed, it will need to evolve a democratic process and to use that process to develop a program of consensus reform that harmonizes the interests of its constituencies. In order to be politically victorious, it will need to reach out to all segments of society and become a majority movement. By such means, the democratic process of the movement can become the democratic process of a newly empowered civil society. There is no adequate theory of democracy at present, though there is much to be learned from history and from theory. The movement will need to develop a democratic process as it goes along, and that objective must be pursued as diligently as victory itself. Otherwise, some new tyranny will eventually replace the old. You've been listening to a reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Moore's writing, including references and other pieces, can be accessed on the web at www.cyberjournal.org or through a link from the Unwelcome Guest website at www.radioforall.org.
I'm thinking tonight of corporations and why they're so different from me. If I did the crime, I'd have to do the time. I'd wake up in a penitentiary. But when you become a corporation, there is a different reality. You can still have free speech, but your crimes are out of reach. You pack the courts, and your judges all agree. But why are the corporations different? Well, the reasons are difficult to see. But without getting specific, Louisiana Pacific could be known by the nickname Felony. And who in the world are corporations? And how did they ever come to be? Before we came to our senses, the fox was in the hen house, and he didn't give a hoot for you and me.
Before we get into our next long presentation on the theme of consensus reality and world domination, here's a brief look into the public relations industry and its role in maintaining Matrix reality. Sue Supriano interviews John Stauber of PR Watch, a nonprofit watchdog of the image management industry.
John Stauber is the founder and director of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. They put out a newsletter called PR Watch, Public Interest Reporting on the PR/Public Affairs Industry. And he has written with Sheldon Rampton several books, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Mad Cow USA, Could the Nightmare Happen Here? And most recently, Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future.
At the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, what we investigate and write about and speak about is propaganda and how it functions in democratic societies like the United States. And in countries like ours, of course, we like to believe that there is no propaganda and certainly no propaganda industry, that propaganda is a dirty word that's out of Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany. It's not even a word we hear much, although I have to say that now that the nation is engaged militarily, we hear the word propaganda, usually government officials or the news media talking about our quote-unquote enemies and what they're doing as propaganda. The reality is that every government agency, every politician, every corporation, every wealthy individual uses propaganda. And in fact, in our country, there's an entire multi-billion dollar industry that provides propaganda services, and it's called the public relations industry. It has sort of a ho-hum, boring, I don't even want to hear about it type of name. Again, we all think we know what PR is. There are these spinmeisters out there who are trying to fool us, but we're too educated, cynical, skeptical, well-informed to really fall for PR. The reality is that here in countries like the United States, we are the most propagandized people in history. As Alex Carey pointed out in his fantastic book published posthumously and now available in the United States titled Taking the Risk Out of Democracy, it's in precisely countries like his, Australia, and ours, the United States, democratic societies where propaganda is most pervasive and most effective. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it's also invisible. The best propaganda, the best public relations is always invisible. So we have a multi-billion dollar industry. It's actually part of the even larger advertising industry. And what it does is construct and wage propaganda campaigns or public relations campaigns to allow established status quo interests, governments, corporations, essentially manage public opinion and public perception. One of the world's largest PR firms that's engaged in this, Burson Marsteller, says its work is to manage perception. And what they do is they seek to manipulate news and media information, public opinion, and public policy in favor of their clients, Fortune 500 companies and governments. That's what we write about, and that's what we've covered for the last 8 years. Our quarterly PR Watch is available up on our website at prwatch.org. We've done a lot in the last year to provide a new feature, Spin of the Day, that has daily reporting on spin. And since September 11th, an awful lot of what we put up every day is information on how various interests are trying to manipulate or manage or sway public opinion and the media in light of the terrorist attacks and the U.S. military response. Mm-hmm. The reason we exist is that back in 1993, after 5 years of working with a nonprofit organization that was organizing farmers and consumers opposed to Monsanto's genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, and watching the Monsanto Corporation in collusion with the dairy industry, the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Bush and Clinton Gore administrations, win that issue through a massive combination of lobbying and public relations, I realized that every issue of importance in our society, issues of war and peace, issues of chemical toxicity, issues of human rights, issues of social justice, racial, feminist issues, any issue on which there's an entrenched status quo, major corporations or government bureaucracies, they are employing, I hate to say it, but they are rather brilliant public relations experts who work with the lobbyists. They craft the messages. They're doing constant public opinion polling. They're developing what are called third-party experts, because if Monsanto, this giant biotech chemical company that brought us things like PCBs and Agent Orange, tells us that sticking a needle in a cow every day and pumping it up with genetically engineered growth hormone isn't going to have any effect on the cow or the health of milk consumers, we might not trust Monsanto. So, for instance, Monsanto, as a tiny part of their campaign, made sure that every dairy research facility at any university or college in the United States received funding to research and test bovine growth hormone. And what they were really buying was allegiance, because suddenly the dairy research facilities were on board. And if you hear a professor from a university say, well, don't worry, this is just a technological improvement, a harmless, naturally occurring protein that's going to allow farmers to do a more efficient job of feeding the world, and you hear it from a professor, that sounds palatable. So the pervasiveness of PR really can't be overstated.
And I understand that there's almost no money for independent research. It's basically all funded by the corporations. I know that when people come out, do independent research, like about cell phones, I know about, then they become immediately fired, blacklisted. It's very serious, and people really need to get this.
It is. That's absolutely the truth, that maybe 30 or 40 years ago, there was more independence at universities and colleges. Certainly, there was less corporate money. There was more public funding. And you like to believe that you could turn to the land-grant universities, you know, the private and public colleges, and speak with professors of chemistry, for instance, about DDT or dieldrin or lindane or Agent Orange herbicides, and get information that you can use about the good, the bad, and the ugly, and take it out into the realm of public debate. But the reality is that today the universities and colleges are proud to be business partners of industry, and especially in this area of genetic engineering. And as you say, when independent scientists speak out, when they stick their neck out, they get it chopped off pretty quickly. There's in our new book, Trust Us, We're Experts, we tell the story of Arpad Pusztai. Most people in the United States have never heard of this extremely distinguished, very conservative scientist who, back in 1997, won a research grant to do one of the very few studies on lab animals to try to answer the question, is genetically engineered food safe for humans? And Pusztai at the Broad Institute in Scotland was one of the world's, some would say the world's leading expert on a particular type of proteins called lectins. And he genetically engineered potatoes with a particular lectin, a snowdrop lectin, that he expected to be safe for human consumption because the potatoes themselves were safe, the snowdrop lectin proved safe, but the genetically engineered potatoes containing the expression of the lectin decimated his lab animals. And so he was interviewed on the BBC, and this was when Britain was deciding whether or not to allow genetically engineered food into the country. Unlike the United States, there was a real debate and public information around it, and they took a very different stance, in part because of Arpad Pusztai saying, I wouldn't eat genetically engineered food. I thought it was safe, but my research indicates it isn't. We need to do a lot more research. Well, he was on the air for a minute and a half, and within days, he was fired from his position. He was locked out of his lab. He's never been back into his lab. His wife, a scientist at the same institute, was told, along with Arpad, that if you two speak out publicly in any way, your pensions are history. And they had signed confidentiality agreements that gave that power to the Broad Institute. Meanwhile, Monsanto and the Broad Institute came out with false information smearing the reputation and the research of Dr. Pusztai. It took him 9 months to correct his image in Europe. Colleagues of his replicated his research. It was published in peer-reviewed journals. This is really important information because it tells us two things. One, there are only a handful of studies that have ever been done trying to answer the question, is the genetically engineered food we're already consuming in the U.S. safe? And a couple of those studies by Arpad Pusztai say, no, it isn't. We need to research the safety of these foods. They should be off the market while that research is going on. And two, we see what happens to even distinguished conservative scientists when they go public. And three, I would say that no one in the United States has heard this story. People in Britain, in Scotland, in the EU are familiar with it. But the news media in the United States, for whatever reason, has not told the story of our Pod Pustai. He's gotten a little bit of airtime, but this is a critical bit of information, precautionary tale, and we're the guinea pigs here in this field experiment that no one's really looking at too closely because, God forbid, there should be proof of harm. But it is a field experiment to see what happens to humans who eat genetically engineered food. One thing that's really changed since the last big war the United States was involved in, the Gulf War, is we all who have computers and modems now or who have nearby libraries or schools have access to the Internet. And I think in the early days of the development of the Internet, there was way too much hype about how this is going to salvage and revitalize democracy. The only thing that's going to salvage and revitalize democracy are citizens in a democracy stepping forward, claiming our rights, and taking power away from institutions which have concentrated power in their hands, like the corporations we write about. But I have to say that there are really good sites on the Internet now where an alternative to NBC, ABC, CBS is available, some good in-depth analysis. Sites like alternet.org out of the Bay Area here are providing a very important public service, commondreams.org, and we see a lot of good analysis and information. I remember the Gulf War back in 91. We were really in the dark. You know, you had to wait till the Weekly came out, or if you sat and listened to community radio stations, you got some information. But there was a massive propaganda campaign back around the Gulf War that we write about in our book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You. The Hill & Knowlton PR firm received $10 million, essentially money from the Kuwaiti royal family, to start a front group called Citizens for a Free Kuwait. And they organized at the grassroots and all the way up to literally the Security Council of the United Nations to create the appearance that there was a massive groundswell in the United States for going to war to free Kuwait. And, of course, the ultimate irony is that there's very little about Kuwait then or now that is free. This was the money of the ruling family. And one of the outrageous stunts that that campaign orchestrated back in the fall of 1990 was what looked like a public hearing in the nation's capital, where a young girl whose name was given as Naira, not her real name, but to protect her family back in occupied Kuwait, talked about how she personally saw babies killed by the score in a hospital she worked in occupied Kuwait, where Iraqi soldiers, for some reason, threw these babies out of incubators and took the incubators back to Iraq. Amnesty International bought into this. President Bush repeated it. And it really was a gut-wrenching story that affected the decision of whether or not to go to war during the Gulf War. Well, a year later, it was exposed as completely fake, orchestrated by Hill & Knowlton. The young girl, in fact, was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. What looked like a hearing on Capitol Hill was not a real hearing. No one was sworn in. It was a hearing before politicians sympathetic to going to war. And even after that was exposed by the CBC and by John MacArthur, who's with Harper's Magazine, most people in the United States have never heard this story.